So today's March 2nd, right? 2011. And what I want to do is continue our focus in this quarter of the year on the intersection of relationships, which is our subject for the year altogether, more or less, as well as the intersection between relationships and what the Buddha called the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is a collection of very important, he considered, themes for us to bring our awareness to and investigate and study and understand and ultimately become liberated by. So it's interesting, isn't it, just to try to put those two together. And in particular, I want to talk about the aggregates, which are one of the five components of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. We already have a lot of numbers here, don't we? Anyway, but the aggregates are actually really important to understand. They have a kind of dreary title, the aggregates, so they're one of the last things people really grapple with sometimes, and yet they're really quite liberating and freeing in ways that are very practical, and I hope to explore with you in terms of relationships. So as a review, for those of you that know this material and for those of you that don't, it hopefully will be fresh and useful to you. The Buddha pointed out that everything, all of materiality, whatever it is, E equals MC squared, energy, quantum weirdness, galaxies, the neighbor's cat, cell phones, sound waves of cell phone ringers moving through space, you know, neural firings that go like that when cell phones land sometimes, or maybe just quiet, serene, tranquil pools that cell phone waves just flit over like the shadows of geese overhead, you know, and moving on. That's a Zen metaphor. Whatever it is, all that plus our experience of the material universe, right? The entirety of our experience of the material universe, all mental phenomena and all material phenomena fall into these five heaps. That's the root of the word for aggregate, skandhas or heaps. It gives you some kind of a feeling for it. They're sort of heaps. What the Buddha's doing as one of the great pre-modern postmodernists is that he's utterly deconstructing experience. And he's doing so secondarily as a statement about the way it is and primarily as a method for liberation. And that right there is an important distinction. Yes, he thinks that what he's saying is true, but he's not going to argue with you much about it because his real interest is it helpful? Does it help us crave less, cling less, suffer less, and harm less to deconstruct our experience and the whole material universe into these component parts? He thinks it does. See for yourself. So what are these component parts? What are these five heaps? All right. So the first heap is called form. These are English translations of Sanskrit or Pali terms. Pali is the language of the earliest surviving written record of the Buddha's teachings. All right, so the first word is form. Form comprises all of the material universe as well as our barest apprehension of it. The other four aggregates are entirely about mental phenomena. Okay, so we get that? Just if you click your teeth together, tap your head maybe, okay, that's form. All right, the Buddha was a realist. He himself was not what's called an idealist. In other words, he thought there really was form, okay? That it wasn't just a figment of his imagination. You know, like you have those stoner conversations in college, whoa, what if we're all like a dream, you know, and he's about to wake up or something, you know, whatever. The Buddha didn't go there, you know. He basically said, look, rocks are hard, water's wet. You know, you may think that stone is a figment of your imagination, but when you thump your toe into it, right, it hurts. So he was a realist in that sense. Later on came certain schools of Mahayana Buddhism, especially in Tibet, that were the mind-only schools, that were idealists who thought that, you know, this stuff's just sort of made up by consciousness. But generally speaking, the Buddha was a realist. He thought, you know, form was real. Okay? Okay so far? Form. The next aggregate is called feeling, which we've talked a lot which we've talked about a lot in here, which is the sense of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. What in Western psychology is called its hedonic tone. Got it? Okay? So things happen, a lot of things happen, they're just kind of neutral, all right? Cell phone ringer goes off. I was kind of grooving on that cell phone thing at the end, honestly, because it was kind of a neat tone. And it just kept going, no offense, it just kept going, and it's really okay. Things happen. I mean, life, as we'll get into more tonight especially, is really messy and discombobulated. And yeah, please try to turn off your cell phones. I quickly turned mine off at the break. You know, my ringer is off because I rarely ever use it, but I don't get any moral cred because I hardly ever use it. You know what I mean? So try to do what you can, right? But for some people, I think the sound of the cell phone, just to use that as an example, is quite unpleasant initially. There was a reaction to it, okay? Others, it was more neutral. Others, it was pleasant, or maybe a mixture of all that. That's the feeling tone. And in your brain, primarily it's the amygdala, the alarm bell of the brain, that is both tracking the feeling tone and kind of boosting it when it's significant, particularly when it's significantly pleasant, or especially, as far as the amygdala is concerned, because it's the alarm bell, when the feeling tone is significantly unpleasant, all right? Great question. Yeah, and that's great too, to slow me down, because this stuff can get kind of abstract, you know? It's great to bring it in. Both significant hardwired, like drop a brick on our foot, that's going to be significant for most people, totally apart from life experiences. But then also significant, as I think you're getting at, in terms of life experiences. You know, for someone who never heard a cell phone ringer before, from some Amazon rainforest, let's say, it would have a very different significance, let's suppose. Just like for us, or at least for me, dropped into that rainforest, you know, the cough of some animal nearby would have a very different significance to me than it might be to someone who knows that that's a man-eating leopard or something like that, human-eating leopard. Anyway, so yeah, that's exactly right. The feeling tone can be conditioned over time, and it can be deconditioned. In the short term, again, this is where I think you're point really is very helpful, is in the short term, the feeling tone just happens. The trick then is to have an inner shock absorber around it. That's what equanimity is. So we don't react so much to the feeling tone. And that's a great way to break the chain of suffering. In other words, we let it be pleasant, we let it be unpleasant, we let it be neutral, but we don't get all worked up about it. And that's a lot of where practice is. That's practicing in the moment, with the feeling tone as it arises. And then over time, we can gradually nudge our reactions so that we have fewer unpleasant feeling tones and more pleasant feeling tones over time. But the trick is not, of course, to get attached to them. Enjoy them, like them, but it's when we tip into craving or wanting with regard to them that we get into trouble. Okay, that's why the feeling tones are so important. The Buddha devoted not just one of the five aggregates to it, but one of the four foundations of mindfulness, because it's such a useful place to look to break the chain of suffering. Okay? In daily life, it's really worth observing, like when you're with someone, to kind of step out of the story about it or the event and just zero in on what's the unpleasantness here for me? And then what are my reactions to the unpleasantness here? Am I truly reacting to the situation, or to the meaning I'm giving it, or really to the pleasantness or unpleasantness of the situation or the meaning I'm giving it? And when you take it to that level, then that can become very freeing. Okay. Third aggregate, it's called perception. Perception means that we know what something is. We've given it a label. There's a lot of relationship between perception and memory. Okay. Then comes what are called the volitional formations or the mental formations. Volitional is a tricky word. On the one hand, it's useful to appreciate that it implies there's a willed quality, a chosen, a selected, a volitional quality to what arises in the mind, or that intentions play a really big role in the various thoughts, emotions, desires, psychodynamics, images, memories from the past, hopes, dreams, aspirations, and all the rest of that, that constitute this fourth aggregate. Right? On the other hand, the word volitional can be a little tricky because it's almost like chicken and egg. Who is it that has the volition? Suddenly now we're getting pretty close to a notion of a fixed self, which is not a very Buddhist idea, et cetera, et cetera. So I myself think of it, the fourth aggregate, really as a catch-all for just mental phenomena in general. We don't need to impute an owner or a causer to those mental phenomena who has volition with regard to them. They can just simply be thoughts, sensations, emotions, wishes, associations, the whole stream of consciousness, the contents of the stream of consciousness, other than the feeling tone or perception, is what goes into the fourth heap. Okay? Kind of a kitchen sink category. Okay, so far? And then the last heap, interestingly, is consciousness, or to use a more down-to-earth word, awareness. And again, here too, Buddhism's 2,500 years old. Early Buddhism, which is to say original Buddhism, I mean, that may sound like an endorsement, but it is original Buddhism because it was the Buddha who taught it, okay? That original or early Buddhism basically looks at consciousness as dependently arising. In other words, awareness is not like there's no cosmic consciousness, there's no universal Brahman or God or ground that the soul is somehow part of, et cetera, et cetera. You know, decide for yourself what you think is true or not, but the Buddha was pretty strong about that. Or if there is that, our own awareness, like the awareness of a squirrel seeing a nut or a lizard tracking a fly, that awareness arises depending on moment-to-moment conditions. Okay, so consciousness is seen, awareness is seen as a process that is kind of mechanical. When there is a sense organ, like sight or sound, etc., or thought, and then there's an appropriate object, like there is a sound, let's say, that meets hearing, then there's a particular kind of awareness that associates to that organ, like hearing awareness or sight awareness, that comes together with the stimulus, the sense organ, and that kind of consciousness to form a moment of awareness. Right? You're nodding knowingly, which is frightening. I know. I mean, it's easy to get really spun into it, but I think the kind of cool takeaway is to allow consciousness or awareness to emerge with its object. In other words, in early Buddhism, there is no awareness without objects. Awareness co-arises, to neurologize it, if you will, representing, which is what I think of fundamentally is what's happening in awareness. It's not an original thought, I think. Representing co-arises with that which is represented. There's no point in representing. Why would Mother Nature evolve awareness? There's no point to it. Consciousness without an object does not confer reproductive advantages in terms of passing on genes, probably. But awareness that can represent sights and sounds and tastes and touches and memories and so forth, now that's going to create a lot of grandchildren, right? Okay? So that's the basic idea. So again here too, now if we kind of step back, the Buddha is just laying this out, and he's basically saying, look, all this fancy stuff that you reify as one person, yourself, or other people, or that you kind of glamorize and make into like, ooh, me, big deal, gotta make myself look really good now, right? He says it's just a heaps, bunch of heaps, like piles of leaves. I think of it as leaves. You know, you ever rake leaves? You pile up these piles when the wind comes along and blows them and they kind of mix together. It has that feeling to it. It's just heaps. Just heaps. So that's the basic structure of the five aggregates. And I think that myself, you know, there's a place for understanding the Dharma. You know, then maybe you want to depart from it. But to me, it's really helpful to at least go, okay, that's what that topic is. All right, any questions or comments so far about the five aggregates? Yeah, please. Okay, of existence. They're all, the idea is that it's all encompassing. The first aggregate is the whole material universe in all its levels and weirdnesses. Yeah, and then he takes experience and he breaks it down into basically four components. You know, the feeling tone, perception, all other mental phenomena, and the field of awareness that represents those mental phenomena. That's his system. Okay, great. So, all right, any other questions or comments about the aggregates? It's very disabusing and kind of disenchanting, you know? It's just like, what? It's kind of reductionistic. I mean, it is reductionistic. We're reduced to a bunch of heaps of component parts that, you know, intertwine and manifest, but they have no fixed center, and there's no owner and no fundamental agent. There's no being there. It's like you can deconstruct anything down to its parts, and you can't find any being there. Do you any more comments or questions? Do you buy it, or can you think of anything that doesn't fit into these five heaps so far? You mean form like a body?
Yeah.
Like physical? Yeah. You could define the body as the being, you know? And, you know, that's a, I think, appropriate thing to do. The psychological sense, though, that the Buddha was really trying to undermine with all his formidable powers as a teacher, really, and a great intellect. You know, it's interesting that Jung, who I think of all the my own view, I'd put him number one as having the most gain, you know, altogether. That's saying something, you know, for me at least. And then Jung, he thought the Buddha was the most intelligent person who ever lived. Even brighter than Da Vinci, Newton, again, saying something. You know, for the, because Jung was not particularly a Buddhist. You know, he was not such. So that said, what the Buddha's getting at is that we tend to have this intractable notion, this very strong notion that in us is a one, a subject who's looking out through the eyes, you know, rather than a kind of swirly, heapy conglomeration of feeling tones and thoughts and wishes and dreams all kind of loosely associated with each other, you know, and that's what he's trying to undermine. So in the sense of that word of being, you can't, in his view at least, find a being anywhere in all this. Whatever you find, you can deconstruct to sensation, some kind of mental phenomenon, and all the rest. And all of those things are transient. You know, the presumed being inside each of us or in others is presumed to endure, right? But if, at least in so far as the body is alive, but even in your own experience, you can't find an enduring being. Everything you find is transient. That's his idea. So you're feeling grounded in this idea of the aggregates? So far, so good? Yeah, it is. It is totally. It, you know, I've used this metaphor. You know, the more you kind of go down this road, you, for me, viscerally, it feels really like I'm like standing and in the middle of a, like a whirlwind with paper and loose leaves and twigs and stuff, and it's endlessly disappearing, and yet this is, here we are, somehow, walking in air, you know? Yeah. So one more, and then we'll, now, then we'll really go wacko. Pretty wacky already, huh? Yeah. Process. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And then as it was raining, it was dissipating.
Yeah.
So it's the one given thing and n given thing at the same time.
Yeah.
In other words, all things back go, all things are back.
Yeah.
But you see how I put it the other way?
Yeah. They pass away, you're putting that one first,
yes.
You mean? Yeah. Yeah. You got to exhale to inhale.
Exactly. Yeah, because that's the skin. So I can get to that. I think that everything passes away. Then it has to kind of put me away because everything
feel very heard, actually. Of course, there's no one here to feel but yeah, but there is a body here. There's a person here. But no, I think we're into it, you know, and I don't know. I mean, people describe relating to this material in different stages almost, you know, and a stage at first is that it's just conceptual and kind of whatever or trippy and whatever, right? But then you start engaging it more and more, and very often what people go through initially is a kind of despair, as a almost nihilistic, like, what? Like, what's the point, right? And definitely, I have had that experience, and some people talk about it in a very profound way. Like, it's just devastating to get the emptying outness of everything always initially. And yet, and there can be sometimes just an intuition of that, you know, like, wow, that's really wild and true. But what often will come on the heels of that, and I could hear it in your voice, is this a kind of exuberance, like, wow. You know, just as it all falls away, it all endlessly emerges, you know, and you can focus on beginnings as much as you can on endings, right? And in that, there's this kind of delight that emerges that allows a certain fluidity. Okay, so now here's the scoop. People usually talk about or write about the aggregates with regard to oneself, right? And the people pursue the implications of that with regard to themselves. That's what we've been doing so far. And that's great. There's plenty of room for that. What I want to open up as a topic tonight is the notion of regarding others in this more, what? As you heap, that's right, Uriah Heep, anyway, you heap, that's right, you know, as heaps, as more aggregated rather than unified, you know, or essentialized. In other words, looking at other people as more like complicated, I think, archipelagos or constellations or eddies in a stream rather than my boss, my dad, you know, my partner, my kid, right? My neighbor, my last president, whatever, as an entity. See what I mean? Isn't this a trip to kind of swirl around? And so to do this, and we're good on time, which is great, I want to invite you to think of somebody in your life and that you know fairly well, maybe an important, complex relationship, maybe even one that troubles yourself, right? A family member, a work associate, maybe a previous significant other, maybe someone you grew up with, parent or sibling. Okay? So if you could bring that person to mind and start by just kind of reflecting quietly. We'll just be quiet here for a bit. You can write if you want. Just start reflecting about some of the complexity in that person. For example, the ways in which, you know, to use kind of classic examples, that person may well have a kind of a fun-loving, sensual or rebellious parts, as well as tighter, more controlled parts. Or that person may have a fairly armored, brittle surface behind which is a kind of soft underbelly, vulnerable, hurt, yearning. You could also think about how the person is changeable from morning to night or from one day to another. Different moods you've picked up from this person, different perspectives. Okay, so just right there, what happens in your own mind or your relationship with this person as you kind of open to some of their complexity, some of the ways that this other person is made up of parts that are changing, and changing based on various causes? What happens when you kind of open up to this, regarding this person in that way? Great. Ah. Yeah. Others? Great. Well, so, yeah, and then you see, is it useful? And it may also be true, you know, for sure. Can you say more, though, about what happens when you open to the complexity or the transient nature of things, or the changing nature of the other person? Okay. All right, others? That's great. Maybe one more. Great. Did others have, I mean, you're talking about a, yeah, Hal, did you want to add? Or? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, so I suspect that, I mean, it's true for me, and I kind of saw nods, you know, that echoed what you said, and what you said too, that when we let others be more complicated in our own mind and variable, something about that has positive effects, right? You feel more compassion for them often. What I go to myself when I look at them like that, I feel less in danger. I feel less threatened. Like they can't hurt me so much, because instead of being some kind of hard object, you know, they're more like, I don't know, a big mush ball or something, you know, this is a something, you know, that's more swirly coming at me, more mutable, more fluid and changeable. So now just another reflection for a moment, if it's okay. Think about some of what you do mentally or have done mentally to, as you said, put that person in a box. In other words, to essentialize that person, to make them into an essence, an entity, rather than a heap of heaps, right? Because that's where we are. We're a heap of heaps. We're an aggregate of aggregates, basically. Right? So, for example, to what extent do you tend to, you know, like just label or stereotype or simplify that person into a role? Like my wife, my child, my boss, my neighbor, my dad, my mom. Or to what extent do you tie them to the past? The past is this fixed thing that they're now tied to. What are you getting so far? Oh, Buddha nature.
So I'm aware that when I see someone in a box or a role or something like that, I experience my own mind, my own awareness. And then I can delight in thinking about what I'm going to do. My mind is expansive.
Great, thank you. Yeah, great. Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's interesting. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, please. You're right. I started with this reflection. So I've been, I'll tell you more in future sitting groups, but you know, I've been pretty engaged with practice in some new ways that I'm looking forward to sharing with you. And this idea of really, you know, this is part of that, you know. And so with myself, I've been watching what happens when I'm talking with someone or listening to them, and rather than presuming, how do I put it, what the brain is constantly doing is this taking all these little parts of the world and forming them into holes. Because that's a great way to not trip over rocks in the jungle, you know, and to find a carrot or avoid a stick, you know, to make it into a whole thing. I mean, the monkeys that were just looking at that leopard going, look at all those heaps, you know, form and causality and the feeling tone arising and awareness, you know, they did not pass on their gene copies, okay? So, but when you're with someone, and just like you were talking there a second ago, and you can do it with other people as you leave here tonight or you're just listening to them, let the person you're talking with not be a entity, but rather, like, be aware of the ways that in their mind, just like in your own mind, all kinds of shit is happening at once. Right? Like, thoughts, we thoughts come out in this sort of coherent way. It sounds so polished. But, you know, you just imagine all the swirliness in your own mind that produces seemingly coherent strings of words. Just imagine what's going on in the minds of those other people. Right? And you start sensing in other people, you feel the tugs. The tug that goes this way. The thought that kind of started out that way but then got hijacked in that direction. And, you know, in a sense, the menagerie, the jungle inside that other person, rather than regarding them as just one being. You know, almost just playing with the idea of the cells. There are literally about 100 trillion cells in the body. It's just this loosely associated city. You know what I mean? It's not like a thing. It's like a weird metropolis. Right? It's just a... It'd be like saying New York is like this. Well, it's like a lot of things. Or SF is like that. Or San Rafael is that. You know, we would allow for complexity when we imagine San Rafael, right? Or Green Bay or New York City. Can we allow for that same complexity when we're just kind of looking at another person and listening, talking with them? You see what I'm... You know, can we allow them to be aggregated and looser and more less rigidly constructed or separated from their environment? And yeah, I am. That's a great line. See, do you have a feeling? And you could do it easily. You just look at someone and you just grant them the same degrees of freedom. The term from math, you know, the same degrees of freedom that you grant yourself. You know, on the inside yourself, you have a lot of sub-personalities, right? There's the little kid who just wants to play. There's the taskmaster says, come on, Ricky, write that book, or whatever it is, you know, your own version of it, right? You know, we all have these parts, and just bubbling here and there. Can we grant other people that same freedom, that same looseness? What Alan Watts said, life is wiggly, right? That same wigginess. Comment? It's trippy to do that. Like, I could go very useful, and we could say, well, that's a monolithic entity that produced that comment, right? And tag you with it. But alternately, there were probably a lot of little choices that had to get made on the way for those words to finally come out. And lots of little choosers, a lot of little volitional formations, you know? Yeah. Take it a step further. If you're a pile of heaps, if you're a heap of heaps, you know, kind of like, you know, Shamrock Brothers, they have these loose stacks of gravel and rubble and bricks and fancy marble and just kind of, you know, that's sort of the way it is. If you're like that and then you let another person be like that, what's it like to be in a room of heaps of heaps? Right? It starts to get very blurry. You know, you want to know the difference between yourself and your landlord, and who's got to pay rent to whom, you know, blah, blah, right? Okay, whatever, right? But it starts to get fairly loose. And what happens as you try it yourself, let yourself kind of see the heaped, compounded nature of other people, right? And then you start seeing the ways that that complicated, messy menagerie, you know, is interacting with other menageries. We're all like zoos walking around, you know, bumping into other zoos in a meta zoo of zoos, right? Called civilization. Anyway, so see what happens when you do that. Like, you could start having that feeling actually in this room here without getting too conceptual about it, but realizing, wow, these tight boundaries that we presume, or these monolithic, you know, entities that we label each other's as. You know, that's what language does. It says Rick, and it's just one Rick, right? Right? Tarne is just one Tarne. But when we move beyond that, we actually start, I think, initially it's a little disorienting and weird, but you start relaxing. You start feeling safer, actually, because there are fewer hard edges coming at you. You know, you start having more compassion for the conflicts inside other people and how hard it is. You know, don't you feel that inside? I feel it inside. It's hard to manage me. So, like you said, a lot of work. Somebody said, who said that? Somebody said a lot of work, right? But just imagine how much work it is for other people to construct themselves minute by minute. This takes you to a lot of compassion. Anyway, what do you think about that? Yeah.
This reminds me of that woman always said, look at other people and be happy to see it.
Yeah. And we, or to really tighten the point here, to see that in them are all kinds of processes that want to be happy. It's not like there's a somebody over there who, as a, you know, and you know that Carol Dunder sharpening the point for us all, you know, it's this monolithic entity, but over there are all these forces, all these longings, and all these fears associated with these longings. This whole very dynamic, loosey-goosey process in everyone. We all try to act so together. You know? What a crock. So, yeah, a couple more and then we'll wrap up tonight. Including really good things. Well, what is to go with that a little bit is you start seeing that the boundaries we put around these heaps of heaps, you know, the five heaps over here, and, you know, the five heaps right there, and the five heaps right there, and five heaps right there, okay, back there. The boundaries start to really blur because we all sort of start partaking of each other's aggregates. You know, as you said, we kind of lean on each other for what we think or what we feel. And at a larger scale, right, like at a microscopic scale, you could see individual cells in this body. But at a macro scale, it's just one body, basically, right? In the same way, if we go pop up to a higher level, wow, it all just starts looking like aggregates. And it becomes increasingly arbitrary which aggregates get localized as Rick aggregates and which aggregates get localized as Harold aggregates. It's just intertwining aggregates. You see what I'm saying, kind of? And that's pretty trippy to really... Sorry, Tarne. There are bad social boundaries, but... See what you think. I think that's where this takes you, you know. It takes you to oneness, actually, you know, and there are aggregates swirling around, and then there's the awareness of them, and that's all there is. And at first that can be, I think, quite disorienting, but increasingly it starts to, for me at least, I think, and I think this is the account of many people, the further you go into this, the more it takes you to this very tender,